she didn't acknowledge me. All she did was grab her canvas slip-on shoes from the plastic tub, shoving them on her feet. Then she bolted. I guess the sudden open darkness didn't frighten her. I guess nothing did. With one last streak of pale hair, the palest on the unit, my cellmate was gone. That was how I ended up alone, with nobody watching out for me, and me not needing to watch out for anybody else. All of B-Wing had been emptied. There was nothing to do but wait for a CO to find me. Or start running. I took off. If a CO appeared out of thin air and caught me, two rough hands shoving me to ground, or worse, no hands and instead the swing of a baton, they'd assume I was like the others, heading for trouble, aching for it. All around me, girls were shrieking and careening down corridors, out for blood and out for the nearest exit. Every last one of us needed to be contained. But I had a different purpose, a sudden destination in mind. I wanted to make sure it was still there, I told myself, that's all. It had nothing to do with how I felt safer there than even inside my cell. It wasn't pathetic. It didn't prove I was a coward. It was where I should have known I'd end up. The prisoner's library was in the corridor outside the cafeteria. It was never locked, and there wasn't even a door to close it off, so none of the books were safe from looters or from anyone else who wanted to destroy something dear to someone else. I expected to come upon a spill of books, from here to at least the end of the hallway. Every shelf to be toppled, book covers stomped on, pages pissed on and spat on, torn skins dropping down from the black sky. I came expecting some touch of chaos, but I guess that would have meant someone else besides me cared. The books were on the shelves, still alphabetized thanks to me. My eyes adjusted to the low light, and as best as I could, I checked their home spaces on each shelf by touch and by memory. Nothing was missing. Zora Neale Hurston was in her place under H. Under B, as she should be, was Libba Bray. Sylvia Plath and Francine Pascal took up an entire shelf of P. The Dusty Dreiser was under D, though no one but me had read Sister Carrie. I'd read everything here, sometimes twice. I sank to the floor, crawled behind the desk, and tucked my knees in, though the space was too tight for me and my shins and bare feet stuck out. No matter how well I thought I knew all the girls here, I was still separate from them, always would be. Hearing the frenzy in the distance, being unable to not hear it, made me aware of the divide all the more. On the afternoons, I wheeled the library card around to each wing, every wing except D-Wing, which lost all privileges, the least of which was book borrowing. I always knew the titles certain girls would want. Jody loved bodice rippers, and any romance. You'd never guess it to hear her mouth. And Peaches was using her time inside to study up on the law. Little T's taste in novels leaned toward the classics, and she was always hogging our one copy of Jane Eyre. Our private taste in books showed a hint of our secret selves, and sometimes I was the only one who got to see those secrets. Of course, I'd skim the books later, after they were returned, searching for smudges and feeling for turned corners and thinking maybe there'd be a message inside for me. There never was. There were messages. Just for everyone else. For girls on A-Wing and B-Wing. For a girl on C who'd been on B just a month before. Whole conversations I wasn't a part of. Coded messages I couldn't hope to unravel. On library days when I doled out the books as part of my life skills job in the afternoons, we all had to have them. I was lucky. I could be counted on to deliver an important message written in tiny script on a small square of toilet paper, secreted in my cart and wheeled from one wing to another. Some of the notes were intimate, blush-worthy, girl-on-girl, and for no one else's eyes but theirs. Then there were the nasty notes, hate so fine-tuned and full of passion, it could get confused for something else. The usual bodily threats, graphic descriptions of disembowelment and shit-slinging, mother insults, creative cursing. I read those notes too. No one could have known if I read the message I was passing, fast, if I maybe memorized it and ran through its words later, gaining access to confidences and dingy, unspoken secrets. No one knew how much I remembered, how I thought it was important that someone here made an effort to remember. I couldn't even remember why, but I knew I should. There were other ways to gather information outside the library, apart from the usual eavesdropping in the cafeteria or slow drifting past a heated conversation in the yard. The beauty salon was another setup inside Aurora Hills meant to teach us life skills for our eventual release. Only those of us without any strikes for 3 months running could stand with a pair of scissors against the nape of another girl's neck, or let ourselves be scissored. All under adult supervision, obviously. And when a girl was in the chair, her hair wet and combed for cutting, she tended to talk. Anyone could have been in the next chair getting a trim and pretending not to listen. Anyone. It was a good thing my hair grew out so quickly. Still, for all my ways, and with all my chances to overhear something worth hearing, I hadn't caught a single piece of information about a jailbreak, even from the girls who made friendly with the COs. No one was talking. No one hinted that something this big was coming, something this glorious. No one knew. So how come I had this prickly feeling, this scratching at me from deep inside? Like we'd run these halls before, on a night just like this one. Like we'd pushed open our unlocked doors and we'd gazed in equal parts joy and confusion and knee-knocking fear at the empty guards' stations. And we'd taken our chances and we'd thrown those chances to the wind and we'd kept on running. All of this was familiar, like we'd lived this night already, like we'd live it again after this. We'd eternally be circling back around to relive it, and we'd never make it out, and we'd never stop running, and I couldn't fathom how I knew this, or why it would be so even if I did. I was huddled behind the library desk, hoping the darkness would shield my legs and all the rest of me, feeling no small comfort from the surrounding shelves containing all my books, and I was asking myself, could I be right? What if I was? What if this had happened already, and this space behind the desk was waiting for me to fill it, as I always did and always would? If I was right, then I could predict what would come next. I centered in on myself and dug around, and let my mind swing open. It came to me. Right about now, I'd hear a song. It'd be Natty. 14 months, domestic assault against her mother. They were arguing over the use of a curling iron. Natty would come sailing through this corridor any moment now, and she'd be singing something familiar. Her voice would carry, and anyone nearby would hear it and hush for a moment, forgetting where they were, forgetting who they were, needing a listen. Natty was the only inmate here who could make every last one of us stop and pay attention without threat of violence. Pop stars had nothing on Natty, except their freedom. I held my breath, waiting. The distant noise shifted, same as before. The darkness kept its shape. Maybe I was wrong. Then I heard her. Natty came bounding around the bend in the corridor, sailing past the bookcases and the library desk where I was huddled, belting out Beyoncé for no apparent reason. It was just as I remembered, hiding here, catching Natty's passing song. A glimmer of memory, a warmth filling me as I recognized the song. I'd heard it on the outside before I came to be in here, and Natty had brought that all back to me, as she always could. And then the warmth sinking and leaking out my toes when I realized what it meant. I knew what was coming. This night would end, and soon, which meant I had somewhere to be. Something rolled over to me on the floor, a flashlight one of the COs must have dropped. Only it looked different from the usual black flashlights they kept clipped to their belts with their weapons. This one was made of cheap yellow plastic, like something someone would pack for a camping trip, if that someone was out in the world the way I wasn't, and could sleep a whole night under the stars. I kept the yellow light, gripped it tight in my hand. I squeezed out from behind the library desk and made myself stand up. I found my footing and wished that I'd thought, like Damore, to grab my canvas slip-on shoes. Something was pulling me down the corridor, after Natty, and toward the heart of the noise. I remembered now. Something was about to happen, and I was meant to be its witness. I let it carry me. I let it carry me. The noise. The loud rush of inmates felt like something liquid and fast-moving enough to pull me along with them, and I didn't fight it. I felt it. Them. All of them. Pushing me forward, wanting me to be the one. Then it... they... let go. I landed on the stairwell between B-Wing and the store window of the canteen, which was closed off with a grate for the night. This spot, which offered a wide view of the facility from the protection of a wall to lean against, secure from sneak attacks, was usually taken in daytime by an armed guard. I kept the found flashlight dark, not wanting to call attention to myself. I waited. Watched. Natty was long gone, and she'd taken the shivery notes of her song with her. Now, in her place, was the girl who didn't wait for me to follow. My cellmate, Damore. I caught sight of her in the dim fizz of light from the exit sign that hung over the fire door. A devil red glow, still faintly lit from the building's emergency backup system, occasionally flickered. She was a crimson chalk outline moving with purpose, and calm, she seemed to know exactly where she was going. The fire door was a door we'd never seen opened. It wasn't an emergency exit we were allowed to step through, even during emergencies. We assumed it shot straight outdoors, to the side yard, the staff parking lot, and all the fresh, free air beyond. This was the door Damore tried to pull open. When it wouldn't pull, she tried to kick it down. Damore was slight, and she didn't weigh all that much. She was flighty and kind of vapid, and we suspected quite dumb. Now she was something else. She wasn't acting dumb. She didn't seem numbed up or high off whatever new substance Peaches was peddling. She seemed hell-bent. The light in her eyes was red with determination. She shoved her body against the steel-gray expanse of the door, yellow hair flying. She wanted out. I'd never seen anyone want out as badly as she did right then. But the door wouldn't budge. Then, she spotted the unbarred window. I caught the rest in flashes. It wasn't that I couldn't focus. It was the lightning, the summer storm raging through the window. She'd be dark and then she'd go bright. Her yellow hair black, her yellow hair white. I caught her, foot kicking out, and the perfect hit in the center of the glass that caved it in. Then came the second and third kicks that made it shatter. She'd gouged open the window into the night. This window was narrow, but so was Damore. She was inside with us, breaking glass with her feet, and then she was outside apart from us, braving the wind and the rain. She bent down to untangle a chunk of long, sloppy hair from the window frame. Her hair came free, and then she was also free and running for the first set of gates. Thunder shook the scene, but it was only weather. At some point, the storm would stop, and the sun would come out, and the whole world would then be there at Damore's fingertips. That was how we imagined escape to be. In the most blinding of our getaway fantasies, we had so many. Any inmate held here at the Aurora Hills Secure Juvenile Detention Center would have rushed that open window. It was our dream come to life. So why wasn't I following Damore? Why wasn't I trying to escape along with her? I had a real way out now, open and calling me closer. I took a step, stumbled. I switched on the flashlight to find the stairs. No one was there to stop me. No one but myself. I should have run to it, dived through, hoping the hole would fit me, kicking out more glass to make room if it didn't. I should have been out there, in the storm, speeding for the closest gate. Any one of us would have abandoned whoever was left and gone running. Sometimes I'm sure I did do it, that maybe I buried it, blocked it out. I have this distant memory, hanging on a ratty clothesline in the backyard of my mind, and in this memory, I am running. There I am, running fast and hard for that window, as if it's a set of doors that will soon be slamming closed to passengers and I'll lose my chance. I will lose at all chances forever. That feels real enough. Glass, shards of it, the edge of the window slicing me with its teeth. Then pain. The pain tells me I really did do this. The pain is too precise for this not to have happened. And the storm, now that I'm out in it, pounds like an alarm of some kind. But not one shutting me down, face mashed to the ground, hands in surrender on my head. It calls me closer, says it's my time now. The whole rest of my life could be found on the other side of that gate. I'm not afraid. That's why it feels so artificial. How could I not be afraid? I don't remember much more because next, something slams against me as heavy as a sack of stones. Reality. That memory, the pain and the wet and the getting closer, the shaky view of the approaching gate, the yellow-haired girl racing for it and me on her heels, but clumsy on my feet, slipping in the mud, unsteady, about to go down. That memory blinks back, blinks away. Gone. No matter how I may have pictured myself escaping this place, face first or feet first, truth is, I can't leave it. I would never. That's my real secret. If Damore had made it out, and I mean for good, we may well have forgotten her. We always forgot girls once they left us. A girl could be a legend among us for months, even years, but once she was transferred, or worse, released, we didn't like to think so much about her. She got blacked out of our imaginary photos, erased from around our tables. We'd recite her stories until the names and specific characteristics faded away, until it was that girl in green, that girl in yellow. Until it was some girl, which may as well have been any one of us. But this is what happened instead to inmate number 98307-25. The girl we knew as Damore. She reached the first fence. She went for it across the mud, and she did make it, soaking wet and shaking. She grabbed her hands to the metal rungs and started to climb. She slipped a few times in the mud, and she lost a canvas shoe, but she kept climbing. She was a pinprick of movement rising up the length of the fence. We expected shots to ring out, The air horn, at the very least, we expected the release of the dogs. But it seemed the only eyes on her escape were our eyes. My eyes. My flashlight beam didn't reach out there, but still I could see her. The lightning made it so I could. She was nearing the top of the fence, and we knew what was up there. Razor wire. Hadn't I explained this to Damore when she first got here? Didn't I tell her what happened to the last girl who tried? A girl, we misplaced her name after she got transferred, made the climb during wreck in the yard when the CO's backs were turned, broad daylight, in view of anyone and everyone, and she thought it a good idea to try her fate at the fence. We watched for a while, chuckling to ourselves, critiquing her moves, until, on delay, the COs caught on. They observed her climbing and only looked on, weapons not even raised. I guess they knew what the razor wire had in store for her, and they had hushed to silence, waiting for the touch and then the screams. Damore didn't scream when she reached the top of the fence. She was tougher than I'd given her credit for. She flinched, and then somehow she vaulted herself up and over with a blast of energy I hadn't seen in all the months we'd shared a cell. She was covered in mud and almost impossible to make out in the dark storm. Or that could have been blood. Maybe the sharp barbs on the wire coils had sliced her clean through. But she did keep going, running for the second fence like she wouldn't need her liver or her spleen on the outside if she could only make it. Here was another thing I'm not sure Damore knew. The second fence was electrified. She might have assumed the storm had knocked out all the power on the property, including outside, so the second fence would be cold and climbable and not mortally armed to zap her like a third rail. It would have been a logical assumption after the locks had opened. She was wrong, though, and all it took was a single running leap for the fence without testing it first. One touch, and that fence came alive. Damore took every volt it had to give her. The sound was a sizzling snap booming through the night. The stink, which reached me even as far away as I was standing, was like a burning tower of tires. It was the brightest light I'd ever seen. Then that light fell, fast, like a meteor into mud, dropping down into darkness. It was in that exact instant when it happened, and this can't be explained to any of the other inmates when they ask if I saw Damore get electrocuted, if I saw her go up in a white blonde burst of flames, and if it was awesome. Because yes, I did see all that. And then I saw something else. Someone else. When Damore went down in that flash of light, the walls shifted around us. A different kind of window came open. And someone just as bright slipped in. There was a face. There was a face in the darkness, down the stairs in the open area near the canteen, a face I'd never seen before, and I found myself drawn to it. I'd had my flashlight trained on the window, but this face had gotten caught in the beam. I knew every face at Aurora Hills. The girls on C wing and B wing, on A wing and even D wing. The warden, at least from a distance, when we caught him through the window, getting in or out of his nice car. I knew the COs by their fat cheeks or their beard shapes, not to mention their knuckles on the crook of a shoulder, the certain kind of way they grabbed. This, though, was a face I couldn't identify. She was a girl, but she wasn't one of us. She was an outsider, a civilian. I'd been out with the book cart Thursday afternoon, and would have noticed someone new being admitted. On Friday, I'd kept my ears open, my head down. No one mentioned a new inmate, and she couldn't have arrived today, because we never got new inmates on Saturdays. Every single day, we talked of our comings and goings, who was being released, who was about to be transferred somewhere worse, or somewhere worlds nicer, and lucky them. We didn't really mean that. Who got sent to the hole, and for what? Who was moving wings and getting a new celly? Who wanted to move but got denied? Lola. Again. And I listened to every word, because I was always listening. I knew every name, every face, almost every crime confessed to, and even some crimes best kept hidden. I had a good memory for details. Before my arrest, I made A's in school. This wasn't one of the girls I'd seen step off the blue bus from county jail. She was someone who didn't belong. Someone from the outside who'd gotten in. I could tell just by looking at her. She had her hair up in a way we didn't wear it here. A neat knot on the crown of her head, held back with shiny clips that would get confiscated within seconds inside these walls. She wore jeans, actual blue jeans, tight enough to fit her, and a sleek little shirt in turquoise, a color not allowed on anyone visiting, since at a distance it blended with our greens. She wore jewelry, in her ears, around her neck and fingers, a circle of gold attached to one wrist. She looked well cared for and exceptionally clean. I couldn't fathom how she'd gotten herself in here in the middle of the night. Had she stowed away during visiting hours? Was she related to one of the COs? The outsider's eyes drifted. At first I assumed she was taking us all in. But then I realized. When one of us lunged at another girl, the outsider didn't flinch. And when one of us wailed close enough to burst the outsider's eardrum, she didn't shrink back. A gang of us crashed through the corridor, and the outsider didn't turn to see, didn't make a break for it, didn't run with us or away from us, didn't do a single thing. She acted as if she couldn't even see us. She was unfazed by the flashlight beam dancing all over her body, shining right in between her eyes. I left my safe, shielded spot by the wall and stepped closer to the railing, risking being seen. The outsider was down below, in the wide open space between gated entrances to the different wings. We were often lined up there, on the way to rec or to class, and once or twice after a violent incident they thought might inspire us, we were chained ankle to ankle, like a slow, sad train. The crowd had dispersed. The rest of us had gone off and left me here, with whoever this was. Their noise, our noise, because I belonged with them more than I did with her, shifted to the other side of the facility. Still, my eyes couldn't leave her, and my feet wouldn't take me from where my eyes held. She turned in a swift circle like she'd heard me, but she didn't look up. She didn't raise her eyes to find me staring down on the crown of her barrette-filled head. I was about to call out to get her attention when everything got confused. The flashlight in my hand started acting crazy. Everything its light touched was changing in the room around us. The walls were no longer the plain, sick-colored green I knew, and the green they should have been. They were a riot of spray paint filled with color. All around, on every wall and standing structure, were spray-painted tags. Bright bubbles of letters, scribbles, swirls, sloppy and angry and awful all at once. It reminded me of something from outside. The graffiti found under a highway overpass when passing through fast in a moving car. My mother used to say bums did it, but it was kids. I was sure of it. Kids who wanted to be remembered, like I did. I used to find it beautiful. When I'd spy a patch of graffiti from the window of the car? Now I did not. Now it was everywhere, on our walls and marking up this place we knew. Too many colors. Ugly colors. I got woozy just from looking. It didn't belong. Many of the tags were hard to read, but I could make out some. Stevie plus baby crawled up one wall. None of us were named Stevie or called Baby, at least by anyone locked up in here, and I wondered about them, if they were still together, Stevie and Baby, and I hoped they destroyed each other, that they broke up and got restraining orders. I hope they never found true love. Many sets of initials, scrawled one over the other, cascaded from one side of the wide space to the other. Someone named Bridget Love had inscribed her name on every available surface, and someone else named Monster had taken it upon him, or herself, to cover it up. I wanted to cover Monster who'd covered Bridget. I wanted to get rid of every last one of them. None of the names on the wall said Amber Smith. None said Mississippi, or Lola, or Little T. We'd been teasing her for months trying to dig out what the T stood for. None said Sherry, or Jody, or Demure. Those were some of our names, and none of our names were anywhere I could see. I wouldn't have known where I was if not for the single painted letter high up on the wall, higher than even the highest tag of graffiti reached. A black blocked stencil that said only B. That meant we were just outside B Wing. Nearby was a black piece of graffiti so enormous my flashlight could barely catch it in one sweep. It said R.I.P. I closed my eyes. When I opened them, I noticed even more things wrong. The sign noting directions to the visiting area was gone. The postings about the rules we needed to obey, no running, hands in view at all times, had been taken down. The grate blocking the canteen was broken clean off, and where the canteen should have been was a dark hole in the wall with nothing for sale. The only other thing the same was the window Demure had thrown herself through to get outside. It was still broken. As I watched, a gust of wind blew what appeared to be a bundle of loose twigs and leaves across the grimy floor. It looked like no one had cleaned the floor in years. I didn't think, not consciously, about what I did next. I started down the stairs, straight for the intruder. She was connected to this, somehow. She'd made this happen. I reached flat ground and went running. I sped up so much that I couldn't get my feet to stop, and almost rammed into her, and I wanted her to fall, wanted her flat on her back, doing some explaining. Except, there was no her. I rammed through air. I turned around. She wavered before me. Her face was urgent and stark white, like a face of the dead. So far, neither of us had said one word. She had these dark blue eyes, much like the sky outside, which had been filled with pounding rain and clapping thunder, but now I couldn't hear the rain out there anymore. Or the thunder. I couldn't hear anything at all, apart from her breathing. Blue, like some kind of warning. No, we were beyond warning. Blue like being thrown off a cliff and sunk in the deep of the sea. That was what I saw when I looked at her. I had no idea what she saw when she looked at me, especially after what she said next. "Ori?" she said. I shook my head, confused. "Ori, is that you?" she said, muffled and mush-mouthed, like she was communicating through the paint and plaster and insulation of a wall between rooms, and I was on the other side, in that other room, my ear pressed to the wall trying to catch what she said. She reached out, like, to touch me, but I wouldn't let her. Who did she think I was? She said it again, that name, and it was the sound of the name that brought it on again, that inside itching, the prickling electricity in a quiet section of my brain. Then, yes. Yes. Ori. Remember? Yes, I remembered. Inmate number 47709-01. Her favorite book off the shelves was going to be the thick, chewed-up paperback we had of 100 Years of Solitude. She was going to say she'd been here long enough to read it 100 times. She would wear her hair much like this stranger, tight and in a knot on the top of her head, but without barrettes because we weren't allowed to have anything with sharp stabbing ends. She'd have mangled feet that she never wanted any of us to see, and a 1,000-yard stare. She'd have a kindness in her that would be foreign to us. And within a week or so, there wouldn't be a girl among us who wanted her dead. She wasn't here yet, but she would be, soon. She'd have to be. She was our 42nd. But how did this intruder know who Ori was? And how did I, if Ori hadn't come up our hill and stepped off the blue-painted bus to join us yet? A shift in the intruder's face. I must have done something to frighten her, in the way I've always frightened people even when I don't mean to. By my size, maybe, since I know I'm a lot bigger than most girls. Or by the scowl that's always on my face, only it's not a scowl, it's just my face. But she didn't know that, because she backed away, put up her hands as if to protect herself from me, and opened her small screw of a mouth. She let a sound come out, and the sound was even smaller, even more pathetic than I expected. Her whole body was shivering, like I was something revolting, and then I guess she knew exactly who and what I was, because she did what I should have done. She ran. We lost. We lost the connection. I lost my sense of time. This could have lasted a few seconds. It could have been a whole hour frozen in the summer heat. She'd gone running, and all that was left was this raw feeling inside me, this burn going all down my throat until it met my stomach and turned heavy, dangerous, until it became a bomb. I'd felt this before. The first time was the day of my mother's wedding, when I was in grade school. She'd worn a white dress for him, which was bursting at the seams thanks to him, seeing as she was months into carrying his child. She'd said yes. She'd made her choice, which involved plugging up her ears and covering her eyes. The choice of telling the ER doctor I'd slammed my arm into the kitchen door, or calling herself so very clumsy as to knock a bar of soap into her own eye while taking a shower. The choice of him over me, over herself. And that day at City Hall would seal it. I gave her warnings. I puked on the floor of the car on the way over, and that was why I was walking into the courthouse without socks or shoes. I grabbed her arm in the parking lot. She'd made me wear lacy white gloves to go with my scratchy, too tight dress. I yanked her arm, holding her back, pulling so hard the lace webbing between my fingers ripped apart and my bare skin was exposed. I didn't want to go in, I told her. Could I stay in the car? I remembered what she'd said to me, and the way she'd said it, with an intense, blinding light in her eyes. She'd said, "Do something for me this once. Make me happy." And she went off without me, the white veil slipping off the back of her head as she walked straight up the steps and into the courthouse, where my soon-to-be stepfather was waiting. She knew I'd follow. A feeling came over me, fury roiling in my gut, fury mixed up with a tinge of fear, rising and rising as I took the stairs. It was because I knew, even then, that she couldn't hear me. She wasn't listening. The second time was the week after my stepfather's accident, years later, when the two police officers called me out of first period language arts class at school. The same feeling from the wedding day billowed around me as I walked up the aisle with my book held against my chest. We were reading Watership Down. I wanted to like it more than I did. I remembered little details, like the turned down corner of the page so I could save my place. My dirty fingernails, blackened and oily like I'd been digging in wet earth. The thudding of my heart in my chest. I never did find out how that book ends. Fury, mixed together with fear, because I was afraid I knew what they were going to tell me. They wouldn't believe me. No one ever did. Everything I know about bombs tells me they are built to explode. But something must set them off first. There must be a trigger before the noise goes off, before the big burst of bright, choking smoke. Otherwise, a girl could stay quiet for years. When the intruder ran from me, she set something off in me. Maybe it was how she'd been so close, her clean, bare shoulder in reaching distance of my hands. I'd gotten a good look at her. She had a bracelet on her wrist that caught my eye, a gold strand with tinkling charms. I could make out every last charm on that gold bracelet. A ballerina. A second ballerina, a third ballerina, and more, all ballerinas. All the gold charms were ballerinas. I'd never even seen a ballerina in real life. The miniature gold ballerinas had their legs flung out of their sockets, their arms thrown up in the air, their miniature toes pointed. Every last one the same. She'd stroked the bracelet with her hand. She held one little gold figure tight in the palm of her hand like she could squeeze it to pulp. But when she'd opened her palm, it was still there. This tugged at me. The intruder looked like she had everything. And that bothered me. She wasn't pretty like her outside parts. Not smooth-skinned and high-cheekboned and glossed like her thin lips. Not made of tinkling gold. Inside, she was swollen and ugly red, inflamed with crusty secrets. There was a smell, too. She leaked it out each time she let out a breath. She was rotten. All I know is when she started running, I, too, started running. I needed to get away from her, that wretched, white-faced thing who called me by the wrong name. I needed to get away from what she'd done to our corridor, our walls, our home. Now that the state had taken custody of us for the life of our sentences, it was our home, even if we would never admit that out loud. She had no right. I heard the pounding of feet behind me, and I was sure it was her chasing me. Had she gotten turned around, decided to come back for me? But I knew this facility better than she did, better than any person apart from the COs. I'd been here since I was barely 14, longer than anyone. I turned a corner. I took a right, a left, another right. She was coming fast behind me. This passage took me into the back hallways that housed the laundry, and then past the laundry itself deeper into the center of the Aurora Hills Secure Juvenile Detention Center. I kept thinking that surely a CO would appear and I'd be caught, but there were no COs anywhere to stop us. There was no one except the two of us. A gray steel door stood between me and turning back, and I shoved it open. The lock was undone, and when the door went slamming outward, the shock of what was there was more than I could take. The fresh air hit like a fist to the eye, and I was down, on my back, in the gravel lot outside the detention center. Above me was the stretch of sky, a clear view of a sliver of moon. Around me was tall grass, run wild with weeds and fallen vines and dropped trash. I'd made it outside. The entire sky was above me. The whole clear sky. Only, no storm was raging, as there had been just minutes before. There wasn't even a sprinkle of rain. The gravel pellets beneath my body were bone dry. The fencing in front of me had fallen over. A gust of summer wind cascaded past me, smelling sweet. Any second now, she should come bursting out of the door behind me, If I looked up, she should be standing over me, wavering in the quiet night with her glimmering gold chain, her feet planted within kicking distance of my spinning head. She didn't come. I was alone. Outside, in a dense thatch of silence that felt like my life before. Before I was accused, when the whole world, my mom and little half-sister included, still thought me innocent. That kind of summer from childhood, when the sprinklers in the backyard come on all for you, and the ice pop on a stick is yours for the licking, and school hasn't started up again and it feels like it never will, and your mother hasn't married that man yet, your mother hasn't even met him yet, and it's still just your mother and you. What I mean is, it reminded me of one of the happiest moments of childhood, before broken wrists and purpling bruises and nasty names hissed when my mother's back was turned, before, who do you think you are? You're ugly. You're nobody. Before a hard, hot twist of a pinch under the dining room table and bursting into tears and being made to sit all night for 5 hours at the table in the dark room until I choked down the cold dinner because he told my mother I had to, because he'd said. I mean before. Before the accident they said wasn't an accident. Before I was charged and convicted. Before riding the blue-painted bus up this hill and being ushered inside this building. There was a time when I could have grown up to be almost anything I wanted, like some of the stories promise in our more happy, hopeful books. I did once have a future. I pressed myself against the gray stone wall of the facility. The stones were cold, but dry and smooth, and they felt right against my back. They welcomed me. Told me to not let go, to stay. Then the quiet bubble burst. A pop, popping, and a slam shook the wall behind me, snaking up my back like an earthquake jolting from the calm. Shouting, the piercing shriek of a whistle. The COs had come out from wherever they'd been. If they'd been sleeping, they'd awoken. If they'd been locked up, they'd broken free. The outdoor lights blazed up, aloft on poles and trained down on every entrance. A spotlight found my upturned face. It wasn't long before a CO discovered me on the ground, splayed out before the wide-open door. I was drenched from the pouring rain that was once again falling and puddling around me, soaking me through. A thick trunk of an arm wound around my neck, and I was lifted up and plunked down inside the building, a bag of meat and bones, more than a girl. I met the concrete, face first, as we were made to do whenever a group of us got out of hand. I had eyes to the floor, nose mashed to the ground. I kept still, hands on my head. But I could see out the still open door if I lifted my head an inch. And what I saw wasn't the clear night I'd run out into. The storm was raging. I guess it had never stopped. And I guess when I got lifted to my feet, that I began clawing and flailing and using my elbows. I was kicking and pounding my fists on the closest surface, which turned out to be the unyielding body of the guard. The bomb inside me had gone off and I couldn't stop myself any longer. I couldn't keep it in. I didn't even know why or what I was fighting. This was familiar. Safe. We knew that the why didn't matter sometimes. And if we wanted a fight, we could always find a what. I was forced back through the familiar corridors and in slow motion, as the plain green walls surrounded me, and their graffiti disappeared, I saw for sure everything was back to the way I remembered. I calmed. I loosened my clenched fists. My mouth closed, and at that point I heard an end to the screaming. The only things moving through my mind were questions. Who was that girl? How did she get in? Did she have anything to do with the locks opening? With the night going so wild? With the rain stopping and starting again? With everything getting so confused and me caught up in it? And why did the name Ori sound so familiar, so significant, like the right key slid into a rusted, forgotten lock? I wouldn't find any answers in what remained of the night. I was secured in a chair as the COs herded down the rest of us, told to shut up, told to mind my own business, told to chill out and wait for my turn. It would take hours, but all of us did get caught. Not one of us made it past the perimeter, though quite a few of us had tried. All we knew was that we'd tasted it, hadn't we? Freedom. Free-floating air on our tongues. What I'd seen was our after. I'd been allowed to witness what would become of this place after we were gone. Rest in peace. Except none of us could do any resting. For now, the electronic lock system had been re-secured, and the power had come back on. So there was nothing hiding in the darkness anymore except the truth. A CO came to retrieve me, at last. But he led me to D-Wing, instead of B. That was bad, though it would get much worse. As the gate to D-Wing came into view, I knew that we had about 3 short weeks left. And then nothing. At that, I was shoved in the hole and locked in.
Part 3, V. From Wide Sargasso Sea by Jean Rise. Justice. I've heard that word. I tried it out. I wrote it down. I wrote it down several times, and always it looked like a damn cold lie to me. There is no justice. Worms and rot. Yeah, the audience loved me. I mean, of course they gave me a standing ovation. They practically ate me up. Which is how they used to act with Ori, before all of what happened here more than 3 years ago, when she got arrested right before she was supposed to play the Firebird, the starring role in our spring showcase. Before everyone turned their backs on her, and my parents made me cut ties with her and attend the other girls' funerals, and the dance studio almost even got shut down. Before, I mean. People used to cheer for her on stage the way they now cheered for me. So much is about how you look on the outside. That's what matters to most people. Smooth your hair and bobby pin it down. Use as many pins as you need. Be sure to flick the eyeliner crumble out from the corners of your eyes. Wear your prettiest clothes. Pale, non-color colors help, like powder pink. Keep that good girl mask on, and no one will ever see past it to the bad, unstable girl inside. At least they never did with me. On the inside, if they could have seen, Ori was good. She loved to dance, and she didn't need music to do it, even on sidewalks or in the middle of the street. She despised wearing shoes and didn't care what anyone thought of the oozing toe blisters on her busted-up ballerina feet. She once burst into heaving sobs when I accidentally ran over the cat in the road, and she stumbled out into the glare of the headlights and stripped off her own coat to bundle the animal in, holding its matted body in her arms until it stopped convulsing and finally was dead. She completely ruined her coat. I stayed at the wheel. Those are some things that no one at the trial got to hear. Because on the outside, after Harmony and Rachel were dead, something went wrong with Ori's face. I try not to think too hard and remember too much about that day. It's best not to. But I do remember the change in her face and how sudden. Her cheeks sunk in, her eye sockets hollowed, the whites gone yellow. Her mouth hung open in shock, I guess, and her dad couldn't afford a dentist, so anyone could see her crooked front teeth. When people decide there's ugliness inside you, they'll be looking to find it on your face. Plus, the practical matters, too, which made casting her as the enemy fit kind of nicely, in a world where people with sad home lives were the ones to do the sad, bad things. She wasn't from a decent family like mine. That was obvious from where she lived. She had no mom, and lots of people had questions about her dad. My own mother went around asking me after, "When was the last time you saw her father? Is he ever home? Is anyone ever around to watch her?" Like that would have made a difference. I tried to explain how her dad drove for a trucking company and could be away sometimes for 2 weeks. Or maybe I didn't explain. Maybe I just said I didn't know. Lack of parental supervision makes children into devils, my mother likes to say. Read the news and you'll see so many abandoned young people doing horrible things. "I had this girl at our house," my mother again. "I fed her my food. I washed her sheets." My mother said a lot more than this, and she bought very expensive sheets. But the point is, she spoke to what so many people were thinking. It was easy to find Ori bad in the days and weeks after. The clues suddenly there for the picking. It wasn't so easy with me. It's curtain call now, when all the dancers of the night return to the stage for more applause, plus some flowers, I hope, if anyone thought to bring roses to toss at our feet. I go out alone to gather my flowers. I try to remember how good it felt to dance for all these people. But I'm cold inside again. I'm an empty tunnel that meets a dead end. After curtain call, the cast backs away from the swish of velvet that swept in for the last time tonight. And everyone's still engulfed in that warm after-show glow for making it through a whole performance without disaster. The audience didn't dash for the exits when the long, boring adagio came on. None of the dancers fell and broke a tailbone. The little tulip in the first row didn't spin around and hit the little tulip in the second row, like she did during dress rehearsal, which got cut short because both tulips cried. No fires. No one puked. No dead bodies out behind the dumpster and girls running and screaming that someone should call 911. We did good. Now that the curtain's closed and the show's over, the older dancers give a big whoop and giggle and wrap arms around one another. Kiss, kiss on both cheeks like they're in France. A twirl in the air, a ring around the rosy like they're children. They are, basically. I kiss no cheeks. I hug nobody. What I do is back away, farther and deeper into the closet pocket of wings. In my arms are all my flowers. I need a moment to myself. And it's not to count my bouquets. It's not until I'm out of view in the backmost section of curtains at the rear wall of the stage, two velvet layers deep and only concrete beyond that, when I let myself hunch over and everything I've been holding in leaks out. It's the performance tonight that did it. How well it went. How every single thing is coming together for me, piece by piece. My dreams coming true, when I'm not sure I truly deserve to have these dreams. I fold up my knees and press my face into my white tights, press it hard, grind it in, and I open my mouth. And nothing. No sound comes out. The ache is sharp. It burns. Like maybe how it'd feel to be the one who got